So which bit by bit are we doing this week, anyway?
Oh, you know, I don't know, but you know what, John? I still keep thinking about what you were saying the other day about the house elves. Joe specifically said that
I remember this just as well as you.
No, she said that just as Dumbledore gave refuge to Dobby, they were free. They so too did Helga. She did not enslave them.
This big elaborate thing with every house elf there with like a Malfoy-like master. They were all given socks by some other Harry-type person. And no, that was just, that's a whole unique event with Dobby.
No!
All
but,
these
but
other
what?
Creatures,
they
probably
won.
Came in wagons to,
okay, guys,
to
guys,
the castle.
Guys,
hey, Melvin.
Oh my god. Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
We're about to start the show, I guess.
Yeah, I know, but you just won't do it. There must be an end somewhere to this argument.
You know, this is all very obvious now. She confirmed this to me on Skype.
What? She did not.
She did. We chat all the time. No, 1142. Are you
okay.
new here?
I am not new here, but, you know, I don't believe you.
Okay, guys, look. There will never be another podcast again if we don't get to the bottom of this. I'm going to call someone, okay?
Oh, you got a number now, huh?
Yeah, I got a number now.
All right. What's this all about? Oh, it's ringing. Good.
Greetings. Thank you for calling the Hogwarts Muggle Liaison Office.
The what?
Yeah, guys.
If you know your party's extension, please press help.
Where did this come from, you guys?
There's another help. Just hang on.
If you are the parent or guardian of a child currently attending Hogwarts, please press 1 now. If you are calling in regard to last week's incident with the giant squid, press 2 now. If you are calling to check on the current status for tickets to any of the upcoming Quidditch matches, please press 3
now. I'm going.
For all other inquiries, please press 4 or stay on the line, and your call will be connected with a house elf in the order it was received.
No, poor house
guys,
elf,
she's trying to figure it out.
Faculty directory.
What was that? We have to
press 0.
Press 0, I think.
Press 0? Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Welcome to the faculty directory.
Yay.
Use your numeric keypad to spell out the last name of the staff member you wish to reach.
I got this.
You
got
it? Okay.
I got it.
Thank you. Please stay on the line.
Good afternoon.
Get away.
Hey, sexy man.
Hang up. Stop. Woo! Hang up. John, why'd you do that?
That's too fun.
Come on, guys. Go seriously. We have to do the right numbers now, okay? Hang on.
Thank you. Code accepted. Please stay on the line.
What was that number?
Just the number.
Hello?
Finny! Oh, thank God.
Oh, who's that?
Hello!
Guys,
hello!
Oh, goodness. Is that Melissa?
It is. Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Melissa. And it sounds like you've got John and Sue with you.
Yeah.
I do.
As usual.
Well, as usual.
Yeah. They're at it again, and I'm going to go crazy.
Oh, no. Not the house elves and Hufflepuff thing again, is it?
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, I think we should sort it out. The best way is probably by asking the expert.
I think you're right.
Well, let me see if we can get a hold of her. Hold on.
Oh, man.
This had better not be about house elves.
So it is. I'm sorry.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. What? House elves? Go on, then.
Still. Well, they are still arguing about this, and I'm sick of it, and we need you to answer it bad.
What I'm telling, too, is that if she remembered from when we talked about this in New York,
yes.
Joe said that Helga Hufflepuff was a plantation owner.
No, but she gave
her
refuge.
Of the house elves.
Refuge.
Oh, Joe.
She didn't enslave them.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. What? You know, I would say that Hufflepuff did what was the most moral thing to do at that time, and we are talking about over 1,000 years ago. So that would be to give them good conditions of work. There was no kind of activism there, so no one's going to say, here's an idea, let's free them.
Yeah.
Let's pay them. It was just, well, we'll bring them somewhere that they can work and not be abused.
Yeah, but she did not go around with like a whip and say, "Ah, you must work in the kitchens," you know?
Right? No, definitely not. That would not be no.
See?
No,
thank you, Joe.
Okay. Well, let's go into this further. Joe, we are about to get ready to start a recording here. We can talk about this for longer if you want. You want to join us for a show?
Well, I've got nothing better to do.
All right, you heard her, guys. Leaky and Pottercast are proud and excited to bring you a very special interview with the one and only J.K. Rowling.
Welcome to another...
The official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
You hear that, Earth? The Leaky Cauldron.
Just go! You're wasting time!
Welcome to Pottercast, your number one source for news, theories, discussion and interviews with people from the Potter books and films. I know a small amount myself, having written the books. My name is J.K. Rowling. I am now happy to introduce your hosts, Melissa, John and Sue.
Yay, Joe!
So I can't tell you how long we've joked in a total like outer space fashion about you doing that intro one day.
Do you know what my favorite bit was? Melissa, when you posted the thing about anyone got extra questions, what loose ends did you like tied up? And the very first comment was, yeah, that's a strange thing to ask us, Melissa. Almost like someone was coming on who could answer those questions. I really liked that.
And I'm glad you brought it up because I have to apologize to the reader of our site called Nimbus XL who actually said that. And I actually came the closest to lying that I've ever done on Leaky when I told everybody, like, calm down, we'd tell you if it was Joe. Everybody relax.
Melissa and Nelly, you filthy, filthy liar.
Yeah. That's me.
Previously respected web mistress.
Yeah, no more. I hand it all in. I'm done. Oh gosh, but we wanted to save the surprise, and Joe, that's what this hopefully is—a nice pre-Christmas surprise for everybody. So I'm more excited than anything that John and Sue now have the chance to get in to hear and talk.
We're gonna give it a shot. I was stunned silly the last time I saw her. I could hardly say anything, but I can't really see her right now, so.
Oh, yeah, you're missing nothing, I tell you. I'm not looking good at the moment. A couple of
weeks
of Christmas shopping and a lot of really hectic life has taken it out of me.
And you've had quite a banner day already with the auction, too, and everything. It's just been amazing for Mr. Beadle.
I feel kind of shell-shocked at the moment. We just watched the auction live. This is of Beadle the Bard, in case anyone doesn't know what the hell we're talking about. And, it went for £1.95 million, and I can't tell you what that means. It's unbelievable. It's just I'm really staggered, and I'm so excited. It's just going to make a really big difference to the charity, and it was a means of raising awareness of the charity, which was at least as important as the money. So it's really done that job. I'm so happy. Can't tell you.
Oh, well, it's just brilliant. And you know, but we're all so curious though, Joe. Is there any little tidbits that you can reveal now?
What about Beadle the Bard, the stories thereof?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you, let's think, Wizards and the Hopping Pot is kind of the moral, really, is it's to teach young wizards and witches that they should be using their magic altruistically. Then Fountain of Fair Fortune is my favorite one, and that's really about the qualities you need to achieve your heart's desire, and the moral being that magic ultimately is not the best weapon. Warlock Terry Hart is really, it's quite gothic. It's quite dark, that one. And Voldemort would have done well to know that story before he set out on his campaign of terror. Babbity Rabbity and Her Cackling Stump is the stupidest title ever written by man or beast. And of course, when I wrote it, I had not at the point when I gave Ron that title. I didn't imagine for a second that I was actually going to write the story.
Yeah.
And I did have there was this kind of margin of time where I could have, where I knew I was going to write Beadle the Bard and the book wasn't published. We were still editing and I could have gone back and changed the titles. And I really liked the idea of keeping those titles and then finding out what the stories were. But Babbity Rabbity was a challenge. But I did get there, and it's a story about revenge, one witch's sort of cunning way of revenging herself for personal persecution, for Muggle persecution. And then you know the tale of the three brothers.
Yeah.
Which is the last one in the book. So I've just given them to you chronologically as they appear in the book. I loved writing them. I really, really loved writing them. But I have to say that before I had the idea of producing the books to say thank you to these key people, I imagined there would be like about 30 Tales of Beedle the Bard. And after I had the idea of writing them out by hand 7 times, turned out there were just the 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't thank you enough for that copy, Joe. I've been reading it to the girls here over the weeks. And
yeah, did you take it? The diamond encrusted version.
It was amazing, and you know, the cover was beautiful.
You don't think it's a bit too bling?
Well, no, I mean, I have a lot of that stuff on my wall already, so it just kind of fit right in perfectly.
John, it was my pleasure.
So
thank you for the inspiration.
It was a pleasure to read it. You know, I do what I could. So.
And did you like the dedication? You were right all along about Hawkery.
Oh no!
There's
that word.
Nobody would believe me.
Well, I did.
He's never going to let it stop.
So I did write him a letter, and I did say that actually Hawkery is, I mean, it occurred to me, you know, it really would have been, I think, a more correct plural, but I already had him fairy, and I didn't want to have too many, you know, dark arts weapons ending in our eyes. So it was a kind of stylistic choice, really. I like Horcruxes as a plural.
It's grown on me,
as
too.
As a linguist. Oh, thanks, John. See, this is why I give him copies of Beedle the Bard. He's a generous man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Joe, but those Horcruxes, though, I tell you, there's so much to ask Billy about those, you know? I mean, we have to know, who created the first Horcrux? Was it Grindelwald? Salazar? Who did that?
Do you know what? I've got a feeling it was Herpo. Which is H-E-R-P-O. I think I call him Herpo the Fowl. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. But you know, wizards would have been looking for ways to do exactly what Voldemort did for years, and some of the ways they would have tried would have killed them. So I imagine it, well, there are huge parallels. Splitting the atom would be a very good parallel in our world. Something that people imagine might be able to be done but couldn't quite bring it off, and then people started doing it with sometimes catastrophic effects. So that's how I see the Horcrux.
Right, because you said that Tom Riddle said there had been, or Dumbledore did, somebody said that there was only one person.
Slughorn.
And we were just...
Yeah, but I would imagine that other people, you know, other people are going to have tried. I mean, I think it would be naive not to think that people have been trying for a long time and thought they succeeded and hadn't, or else, you know, maimed themselves or killed themselves in the attempt. It's such a dangerous thing to do.
Oh. Evil thing, you know, just...
Yeah.
What is the process? Is there a spell? Is there a... What do they have to do?
I see it as a series of things you would have to do. So you would have to perform a spell. But you would also... I don't even know if I want to say it out loud. I know that sounds funny, but I did really think it through. There are two things that I think are too horrible, actually, to go into detail about. One of them is how Pettigrew brought Voldemort back into a rudimentary body.
Yeah.
Because I told my editor what I thought happened there, and she looked as though she was going to vomit. And then, and the other thing is how you make a Horcrux. And I don't even like, I don't know. Will it be an encyclopedia? I don't know if I can bring myself to, I don't know.
Oh, Joe, you mentioned the E-word. Encyclopedia.
Oh, God, yeah. God, yes, I did.
Yeah.
We should call it something like the Scottish book.
Yeah. Scottish book.
Oh, geez. You don't want to curse it now, Joe.
It's not going to be mentioned live on air.
Yeah, exactly. We can't wait for that. We hope you get on that as soon as you feel comfortable doing so.
Yeah. Would it be okay if that's 10 years? No one
will be around.
No, listen, I absolutely do intend to do it, but I you know, I can't pretend that I'm in a hurry right now. It's going to be a hell of a lot of work, but I have, you know, I've kept everything, and I know where things are, and yeah, at some point I will get myself together and do it.
I was going to offer, just in case you needed help on that particular chapter, I've got a lot of baby pictures and childhood anecdotes for the Dalek chapter.
Here we go.
That might just help fill things in a little bit.
You know what? Again, John, you're always there when I need you. That's great. That would be great.
You know, Joe, he idolizes a man, an R, who got pwned by an old lady wearing a dead bird on her head, you know, in her hat. Now, come on.
You guys, now, they don't understand this, Joe. I know we've talked about this.
They don't understand the night that this, they call it a duel. It wasn't a duel, at least in my mind anyway. I think it needs a little explaining of how somebody as, you know, as skillful as Dawlish, you know, could have,
you know,
got taken down like this.
John.
And feel free to let all the air out of my sails. That's
listen,
fine.
John maintains
like.
That she sucker punched
him. You know
him.
What?
She sucker spelled
I find
him.
It so incredibly endearing that you like John Dawlish. And that's why his name is now John Dawlish, as we know. In tribute to you, and that will indeed be a note in the encyclopedia, or the Scottish book, as we are now calling it.
Yes.
Dawlish had to be good. He had to be good because he became an aura. There's no denying that. But he has his weaknesses, and Dumbledore knew how to exploit them. You know, and let's face it, anyone going up to Dumbledore pre-trying on the Horcrux, pre-maiming his hand, anyone is going to be in trouble going up against Dumbledore. Even Voldemort didn't want to do it. So it's no dishonor to Dawlish.
Well, certainly. Was Dumbledore involved in...
In weakening
him? I mean, they
said
it was Mrs. Longbottom.
Well, that's after... You know, by the time Augusta Longbottom got to him, he had been...
Right.
Several people had attacked a Dawlish. I mean, I think he was a bit punch drunk by that point. You know, he had become a favourite favourite punch bag of the Order of the Phoenix by then. So I don't think he was firing on all cylinders, but no, I really saw Mrs. Longbottom as a powerful witch.
Yes.
So, sorry.
I suppose.
Do you know, I went down to Leavesden recently, and I saw Michael Gambon with his withered hand. That was quite exciting, yeah.
Gosh.
There was just a funny report about Michael Gambon, and we're pretty sure he was joking about that he was scandalized to learn that one of his lines was lifted directly from the book and was railing around, cursing and throwing things.
How dare they use your words, Joe?
Listen, Michael has a very good and very dry sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And you should really, he's a funny man. And you should bear that in mind and not take things as they may appear flat on the page.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Dumbledore,
we
want to talk about Dumbledore so bad. We know that you've created worldwide intrigue when you said that he's gay, but I wanted to ask you about homosexuality in the wizarding world in general. Is it a taboo?
Now, that's something I never thought of. I would think that would be exactly what it is in the muggle world. But the greatest taboo in the wizarding world is, well, for some wizards, I mean, if we're talking about prejudiced people within the wizarding world, what they care most about is your blood status. So I think you could be gay, pure blood, and totally without any kind of criticism from the Lucius Malfoys of the world. I don't think that would be something that would interest him in the slightest. But, you know, I can't answer for all witches and wizards because I think in matters of the heart, it would be directly parallel to our world.
Hmm.
Yeah. The reaction was so astronomical to that.
Well, I said it to you, Melissa, before, I think, that to me it's wrong not to answer a question honestly. I just think that's immoral. And I was asked that question by a young woman at Carnegie Hall who prefaced her question by saying, these books have helped me be more fully myself. Well, I mean, that's just one of the most wonderful things anyone has ever said to me about books. And then she asked, has Dumbledore ever been in love? Now, so I was absolutely honest about how I saw the character. I always imagined that Dumbledore was gay. How relevant is that to the books? Well, it's only relevant if you considered that his feelings for Grindelwald, as revealed in the seventh book, were an infatuation rather than a straightforward friendship. That's how I think, in fact, that I know that some perhaps sensitive adult readers had already seen that. I don't think that came as a big surprise to some adult readers. I think a child would see a friendship and a very devoted friendship, but these things also occur. How relevant is it? Well, to me, it was only relevant in as much as Dumbledore, who was the great defender of love and who sincerely believed that love was the greatest, most powerful force in the universe, was himself made a fool of by love. That, to me, was the interesting point, that in his youth, He became infatuated with a man who was almost his dark twin. He was as brilliant, he was morally bankrupt, and Dumbledore lost his moral compass. He wanted to believe that Grindelwald was what he wanted him to be, which I think is what particularly a young person's love tends to do. We fill in the blanks in the beloved's personality with the virtues we would like them to have. So Dumbledore was wrong, and his judgment was very suspect at that time. And of course, it was more than being infatuated. Grindelwald appeared to be offering him a solution to this horrible dilemma. I mean, Dumbledore was not cut out, to his shame, to be a carer. He was cut out to go out onto the world stage and be a brilliant man. He knows that about himself, and he's ashamed of it. So it's a complicated issue, but yeah, that's the way I always saw Dumbledore. It wasn't a particularly big deal to me, and I'd never once before been asked at an event about Dumbledore's romantic life. I'd been asked other things about him, but I have to say that until Hallows was published, people were mostly interested in the trio's futures and Dumbledore's backstory. In fact, I remember, Melissa, when you and Emerson interviewed me after Half-Blood Prince was published, we were talking about what fans should be asking, and I said Dumbledore's family. I didn't want to say Dumbledore's past, but Dumbledore's family would be a profitable line of inquiry, because I always knew that he had this tragic story from his late teens. There, that was a long answer.
No, it's brilliant.
But it was a full answer.
Oh, we love full answers.
You know, I guess, you know, oh, people are going to yell at me.
Like you care, come on.
Okay.
I mean, we love when you start sentences that way.
Just trying to save a little face. I know a few people out there have been wondering if Madame Hooch had ever been in love.
You know what? Madame Hooch really did not have any kind of romantic backstory. Well, not of my invention, I don't know. We'd have to go and trawl the fanfic for that.
I'm sure we'd find it, Joe.
Yeah, I bet we would.
I think there's categories of it, actually.
Yeah.
So we were talking about ships, though. Can we talk about romance at all?
Yeah, we can talk about romance.
I don't know. The last time we did this, Joe, quite a lot of hubbub follows.
Really?
You know.
But it's fun. It's fun hubbub.
Yeah, okay.
But before we get too into romance, I wanted to get something cleared up.
Okay.
After we came back from Carnegie Hall, we brought back your message of Harry is kind of not really a Horcrux. And I don't want to dwell too long on Horcruxes, but I'd love to hear you talking about how he is or isn't or wasn't.
Well, I'll tell you, this will not end the discussion. I know that and you know that, but here's the thing. For convenience, I had Dumbledore say to Harry, you were the Horcrux he never meant to make. But I think by definition, a Horcrux has to be made intentionally. So, because Voldemort never went through the grotesque process that I imagine creates a Horcrux with Harry. It was just that he had destabilized his soul so much that it split when he was hit by the backfiring curse. And so this part of it flies off and attaches to the only living thing in the room, and part of it flees in the very close to death, the limbo state that Voldemort then goes on and exists in. I suppose it's very close to being a Horcrux, but Harry did not become an evil object. He didn't have curses upon him that the other Horcruxes had. He himself was not contaminated by carrying this bit of parasitic soul. The only time he ever felt it stirring and moving was in Order of the Phoenix, when he himself goes through a very dark time. And there's a moment where he's looking at Dumbledore and he feels something rear like a snake inside him. And of course, at those times, it's because the piece of soul inside him is feeding off his emotions. He's going through a dark time and that piece of soul is enjoying it and making its presence felt. But he doesn't know what he's feeling, of course. Also, I always imagine that the Sorting Hat detected the presence of that piece of soul when Harry first tried it on, because it, you know, it's strongly tempted to put him in Slytherin. So that's how I see it. Now, I know that won't end the debate, but I do think that the strict definition of Horcrux, once I write the Scottish book, will have to be given.
Yes.
And that the definition will be that a receptacle is prepared by dark magic to become the receptacle of a fragmented piece of soul, and that that piece of soul was deliberately detached from the master soul to act as a future safeguard or anchor to life and a safeguard against death. So that doesn't really clear anything up. I think that's, well, I think it elucidates what I believe, but I don't think it's necessarily going to convince people who have a strong feeling one way or the other on the matter. You know what, that's been the case with most of Harry Potter. I give my explanation and it just fuels more debate.
Okay, I was thinking as you were talking about that just a second ago, I had just been reading Philosopher's Stone. There was a chapter when Harry goes to sleep for the first time. And he's in his dormitory, and he has a dream that you wrote he never remembers again, and it was being tempted, you know, go Slytherin. I thought maybe at that point that might have also been that little piece of Voldemort in there wreaking havoc on his dreams really early on.
Well, of course, the pain he feels whenever Voldemort's particularly active is this piece of soul seeking to rejoin the master soul. When his scar is hurting him so much, that's not scar tissue hurting him. That's this piece of soul really wanting to get back out the way it entered. You know, it really wants to, you know, it entered this boy's body through a wound, and it wants to rejoin the master. So when Voldemort's near him, when he's particularly active, this connection,
oh my God,
it was always there. That's what I always imagined this pain was. Yes. So there you go. There's a moment when Dumbledore casts a charm and you see a two-headed snake split.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay. And that's divided?
Yeah. That's in his office,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's in Dumbledore's divided. Office, and he suddenly does these strange, he performs this strange piece of magic in which he watches images, and these are his, and the snake dividing, that's the way he sees Voldemort's soul dividing. So he's playing through his own theory about what's happened, and his theory is, of course, correct. That Voldemort, as summed up by the snake, divided. So Harry never understood what the two-headed snake was all about, but that's what it was.
You know, you just answered a question that people have been asking about, talking about that essence divided, what that meant. So,
in essence divided, exactly. The essence being the soul. So Dumbledore knew all along that he suspected until Chamber of Secrets. And then at the point where he saw what was clearly the remains of the Horcrux, in other words, the diary, he thinks, okay, there you go. And not only has he definitely done it, but he's got to have more than one because he's treated this one very casually.
So can I ask this? This is kind of a random question, but if Harry had this Horcrux in him, sort of, would he have actually have died, like say when the dragon could have killed him or when he was falling during Quidditch or anything? Could he have actually
died? Got to, if his body had been irreparably destroyed, he has to die to get rid of that piece of soul. His body has got to be irreparably damaged. So a lot of people asked, and I think I've answered this since, but a lot of people immediately said, having finished Hallows, but then that means in Chamber of Secrets when, you know, he was pierced by the basilisk.
Oh,
but no, he didn't die. He didn't die. That was stated right in the beginning with the Horcrux. The receptacle has got to be destroyed. His body wasn't destroyed. He got a bit poisoned, and then he got the antidote immediately. So, you know, that's not going to drive out this piece of soul. Sorry if I sound frustrated, but occasionally, you feel some frustration in that people, please just read the book because it's there, and then ask something that's not there. That would be, you know, which plenty of people do, don't get me wrong. But on that one, I felt there was a certain feeling of weariness.
Now I'm nervous.
No, don't be nervous. It was, but because I was so careful with this stuff. And it's, I don't know if you've seen on my website, I recently did a small number of updates. And one of the things on there was, it's about the end and how Harry survived right at the end, that fight when he doesn't fight and Voldemort uses the killing curse on him. Well, it was important for me to say on the website, I never saw this, the finale, the denouement, the moment when Harry faces Voldemort, is prepared to die, and it doesn't die. That isn't like a scientific equation. Harry, it's not guaranteed. There has to be space to make Harry truly heroic for free will. It has to be his choice. The whole thing's his choice. He chooses to sacrifice himself, just as Lily chose to sacrifice herself. He chooses to pull himself back to life. And that's his, you know, his own will and courage. So ultimately, those things, all of them, were more important than the magic.
Wow. My brain is firing in so many different directions right now because I got like 1,000 questions.
And I'm sitting here biting my tongue.
Because I want to ask you about your website, and then I want to ask you about love, and it's just like...
Yeah, we were going to talk about romance, and then we got sidetracked.
Yeah, sorry.
I am no Ravenclaw, and I read these books just because I love them, and I'm in... just am enamored of the world that you've created. And the one character I do see in myself is someone named Neville Longbottom.
I love Neville. I love Neville so much. Always loved Neville. And I always saw, and I always had big plans for Neville, you know? And he really was the boy it could have been. Because, as you know, as I make clear, he was born hours before Harry. He was born on the 30th of July. Voldemort singled him out as the other possibility. But the great thing about Neville's story for me, the overarching story about Neville, is that he proves himself to be a boy who could have done it too. Yeah, Harry had the scar, and arguably Harry had an edge more talent, because Harry, he has an extraordinary instinct for the right thing to do. He's just got the right instinct, and that's what would make him, in due course, a phenomenal aura. But Neville was, I think, amazing in the final battle, and proved himself 100 times over worthy of being a Gryffindor, his parents' son, despite the very difficult childhood that he had at the hands of his very pushy grandmother. And I know she loves him and he loves her, but she's not an easy person to be raised by. So yeah, so that for me was the big thing about Neville. He was he's not on the surface. I suppose he's not as cool when it comes right down to it, although Harry, of course, made himself cool. He was a scrawny little kid in glasses, and he comes through and becomes the guy everyone wants to know.
Yeah. You know, the scene, you've written so many brilliant scenes, but I personally think one of your most powerful scenes was when Neville goes into St. Mungo's. And I understood when I was listening to that scene that Neville probably never had the love of his mom and understood that, like, hugs, you know, all he got were these.
Yeah, all he got were these elderly relatives who just wanted him to match up. Why aren't you matching up? And the trouble is, I think, that they would be the kind of people who forget what being young is like and want him to be, imagine themselves to have been prodigies and expect him to match up to really an impossible standard. So I felt so sorry for Neville from the word go, but I knew that he was going to have a comparable journey to Harry's, and he does. And bizarrely, Matthew Lewis, who plays Neville, has undergone a bigger physical transformation than any other person who works on those films, to the point that when I went to the read-through of Half-Blood Prince, that we were all sitting in this great square, they put all the tables from the great hall into this big square, so everyone's facing inwards for the read-through, and facing me were Dan and Rupert and Emma and Ivana and Bonnie and, you know, the main lot, and then there's this really big cool guy sitting there with a bit of stubble and wearing this woolen hat and a leather jacket, and I didn't recognize him, and my eyes pass on, and I sort of thought, oh, that'll be the guy they've got playing McLagan, you know. And then I thought, where's Matthew? And I looked back and, my God, when did that happen? So he's really a very cool dude. And, he and Devon and Ivana and Bonnie all came to my reception for Beadle the Bard last Monday. It was great to see them. It was so nice.
Oh, that's so cool. Can we just ask a kind of sad thing, though? What did the Longbottoms do that they earned that wrath from Bellatrix? Such, you know, there were 3 times like the Potters.
They were efficient. Dark Lord. They were efficient. That's all they needed to be to earn her wrath. They had rounded up Death Eaters. They were very good auras. They knew what they were doing. They were responsible for a lot of captures and arrests and imprisonments. And so there you are.
What about the 3 times, the thrice defying of Voldemort?
Of James and Lily?
Of Neville's parents. Well, James and Lily too.
Well, I mean, it depends how you take defying, doesn't it? I mean, if you're counting, well, which I do, any time you arrested one of his henchmen, any time you escaped him, any time you thwarted him, that's what he's looking for. And both couples qualified because they were both fighting. Also, James and Lily turned him down. That's established in Philosopher's Stone. He wanted them. And they wouldn't come over. So that's one strike against them before they were even out of their teens.
Rock. That's so cool. I was glad to hear more about them, the night of their murder in Deathly Hallows, but there's still a little bit of confusion about that 24 hours, Joe. And then how did Dumbledore find out what happened in Godric's Hollow?
And what happened? There's this whole 24 hours that's like people have been fantasizing about for years.
Yeah, I know. You know, I've got a bit of a problem with this myself, because every time I think it's straight in my head, I go back and look at what the fans are theorizing about, and I think, yeah, maybe they've got a point. Dumbledore, well, there's an easy answer to how would Dumbledore know, because you can one can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Forgive me if I speak as though it's all real for a moment.
it is real. What do you mean it's not?
That's how we all do it.
I know, exactly. That's how I feel as well. Yeah, so, okay. Obviously, Dumbledore could cast a charm on a dwelling that would immediately alert him if something happened to it. So he could know instantaneously. That's not a problem at all. And then he could dispatch Hagrid and so on. But I think the Scottish book will have to answer that question. I'm gonna have to really go back through notes and either admit that I lost 24 hours or, I don't know, hurriedly come up with some backstory to fill it. Either way, you either get to be right or you get more stories, so you can't complain.
Okay.
No.
now I have to ask, and I don't know if it's something that you have probably haven't even decided it yet, but when you do go back and you do... You know, in 10 years, so be it, mm-hmm. do the Scottish book. Are you thinking more in line of an account of events or more like small stories for things?
Well, to be honest, John, at the moment, but I'm not going to say don't hold me to this, but, you know, I'm just going to say this might change. But I imagined it as half of it. I mean, maybe on facing pages, but that might be difficult to do just through layout. But the ideal would be to have... Say on the left-hand side, you've got a page showing all your backstory, extra details on characters, or an entry on wands showing what every character's wand was and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I think also it might be interesting to have information about the actual writing and what I discarded. So on one side, it's acting as though the whole world is true and I'm giving you extra information on that real world. And on the other side, we're admitting that it's actually fiction and I'm showing... Yeah, discarded plots, characters that didn't make it, problems in the plot. I think both lots of information are interesting, so it would be nice to unite both of them.
Absolutely. That sounds like a student's textbook.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
In the margins they have, fact tables and things, and then there's also like snippets of stories that they rescued from things, and then...
Well, exactly. To be honest, I think the point of doing it, if I'm going to do it, it's about doing the absolute definitive giving people everything guide.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, everything. Could I ever give everything? But everything that I've got, put it that way. That's what I would aspire to at the moment. It might, for practical reasons, not be possible to do both sets of information in that way. But I would like to. That would be the ideal.
I think fans would wait 10 years for something like that.
Oh, well, if that's the case, then I'm delighted. Because I don't... You know, what I really... I mean, I don't want to get into, God knows, I do not, this near Christmas, want to talk about legal stuff. It's just too depressing. But I think there's no point me doing it unless it's amazing. I think there's no point me writing it unless it is everything. And the last thing I want to do is to feel that I have to rush something out because, do you know what I mean? My hand has been forced or I've got to rush it out because there's demand and other people will fill it first. I want to do it right. Or not do it at all, and I really do want to do it right.
Well, I'll wait 10 years if you give me a little bit of the history of Hufflepuff, and then I'll be just happy.
Yeah, well, I would definitely, that's all of it, yeah.
Oh, Hufflepuff.
It's been 130-some weeks, and we've managed to get you on the show, so, I mean, 10 years, what's the matter?
Yeah, what's it matter? That's the spirit, John.
I don't know, you guys are being very permissive about this whole 10 years thing. I don't know, man. Let's not expand it. No, I'm kidding. Since you mentioned Hufflepuff, I want to ask a sort of specific question about Hannah.
Yes.
Hannah
Abbott?
There's a line in Deathly Hallows when Harry sees the someone that he thinks might be Hannah Abbott's long-lost relatives. What's her deal? Is she a muggle-born? Did she lose her family?
Oh, you mean the grave?
Yeah.
No, she's not muggle-born. I'm pretty sure Hannah's pure blood. I know her mother died.
In an old documentary, you showed a picture that had like all the family associations, and Hannah appeared to be muggle blood in the fans' careful deconstruction.
Because
of that
I tell
picture.
You what, if that's the case, I've got that notebook, and that's one of my cornerstone notebooks. In that case, then I have been misremembering that because I thought she was pure blood. But interesting. Because I've certainly written about her and thought about her for years now as pure blood. So that's interesting. Maybe we'll just split the difference and call her half blood. Yeah, that's how decisions are taken in the fairly random world of J.K. Rowling.
I didn't care, though, because Hannah goes on to become landlady at the Leaky Cauldron, my favorite pub, and I was...
Damn right she does, and I think that's a very cool... I think that's a pretty cool career, and I think that makes Neville quite
yeah.
cool that he married her, don't
yes,
you think?
It does.
Woohoo! Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thank yeah. you, Joe. I
my
loved
pleasure.
It. You know, I love your website. You made Hufflepuff, you know, when you did the Four Founders, and you had all that stuff, so we are really, really grateful to learn about all those things. So
thank you.
Bring it on.
I know that the website's been really quiet lately. I said in my diary entry, people around me keep saying, oh, I must be really quiet now. They have no idea. The second half of 2007 has been insane and manic and strange right. and full of stuff that I'd really rather not deal with. And I'm afraid to say the website's one of the things that kind of went by the by. I hoped by starting the website, which I've enjoyed so much, it's been a great way to directly communicate with fans and definitely the most effective way I could have found. I was getting a lot of pressure or a lot of requests to do a fan club, you know, from people who wanted to run it and people who wanted to have a fan club. And I really didn't want to do a fan club because I thought that they're nearly never as good as they promise to be, you know, and they're never free and you've got to pay and then a lot of material needs to be generated. And so I thought doing the fan site, creating that, at least it would be free and people would feel that, you know, they were getting something. So if there was a quiet phase, then it wouldn't matter too much. I do need to update, and I will.
Yes, because we're dying about those wombats, you know.
Oh, God. Listen, I've got to tell you, the wombats are done. I'm sorry. There are no more wombats.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I did. You know, I worked really hard on those wombats.
Well, but what was the purpose of them, though? Just for fun? Just to do those? I mean, why did you... We felt like, oh, man, we're like...
I'll tell you what it was, and this is kind of sad.
Yeah.
I was told that it would be very unwise to put hints about Hallows on my site because we had enormous trouble in Half-Blood Prince because I had put hints about it, and then it was argued in court by people who wanted to put the whole book on the internet or press people who had got hold of it and wanted to put it out early, and an argument would be, well, you put it on your site, so we have the right to put it up as well. So I was told it would be very foolish to start putting chapter headings and so on up. I would be weakening my own case against people who wanted to do spoilers. So then I started looking for something that I could give fans that wasn't foreshadowing. Although I hope you noticed, sorry, I'm going off a slight tangent.
Yeah.
I was going to say to give fans stuff that wasn't foreshadowing book 7, but in fact, if you were paying attention, Wombat 3 had loads of stuff from book 7 in it. And no one knew and no one realized, including the lawyers. Yay, so I win.
Yay, yes, you win. Yes, you do. You go, girl.
Thank you.
So
actually, there was a whole lot of stuff in Wombat 3 that was taken from 7. And people picked up on it, on some of it. I had some stuff in there about Gryffindor's sword and a few other things. So,
will you put up the answers so that people can kind of figure it
out.
You
know, I could put, would you like that? Would that,
yes,
I would
please.
Love that. That would be fun. Okay, that would be cool. It did amuse me. I can't remember. Someone gave, some site gave a guide to what you should be putting, and I think people who followed their advice were not getting the top mark, so. Anyway, there you go.
I mean, I got an O on all of mine.
He did.
Really need the answers.
Did you? Well, the embarrassing thing is my husband only got acceptable, and he was in the room while I was writing the questions and was listening to me telling him the answers. So what that says about how much my husband listens to me, I shudder to think.
That sounds very much like a Hermione Ron kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. We have our moments, believe you me. Yeah, so he got unacceptable and then got discouraged and didn't take another one.
Yeah. That's very Ron.
Yeah.
Oh, well, speaking of Ron and Hermione.
Yeah, did they graduate from Hogwarts?
Yes, did they?
Harry and Ron didn't go back, Hermione did.
Oh,
my goodness. Did you bet right? You must have. I mean, come on, no one's going to think Hermione wouldn't go back.
I predicted, yeah.
Of course she'd go back. She has to get her news. Ron was really done with schooling, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be kind of tempting to go back just to mess around for a year and have a break. But he goes into the aura department. He's needed. Anyone who was in that battle on the right side, Kingsley would want them to help clean up anyone, you know, who's old enough to do it, who's overage. But Kingsley would have wanted Ron, Neville, Harry, and they would have all gone and they would have all done the job. And I think that would have been a good thing for them too, because to go through that battle and then be relegated to the sidelines, I think they would have felt a need to keep going and finish the job. So that would have been rounding up the corrupt people who were doing a Lucius Malfoy and trying to pretend that they weren't really involved.
Wow.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah, we had all been thinking of these big complicated, we always overcomplicate things.
Yeah,
like,
you do.
You know, maybe they do this distance, they do this distance learning kind of thing where they're working in school from home. Yes, exactly.
Yes. We were imagining Hermione on the back of the dragon on the deluxe edition doing her newt.
Yeah, we did. You know.
No, she would definitely go back, and she would want to graduate. And I think that she was, I mean, I love Hermione. She went with Ron and Harry because she has a really good heart. That's not about brain. Ultimately, she had a bigger heart than she had a brain, and that's saying something for Hermione. But was she naturally drawn to battle? No, she wasn't. She's not a Bellatrix. She's not a woman who actually wants to be hurting, fighting, killing, not at all. She would be glad to go back to school, be glad to get back to study, and then would join them at the ministry.
Now, you know what I'm curious about now?
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the neatest things I think about the Hogwarts tradition is the entrance ceremony, you know, from the whole riding the boats to the castle to the sorting ceremony. What kind of traditions is there for graduation and leaving Hogwarts?
You know, John, I'm really glad you asked that, because I felt a huge sadness that I wouldn't write a graduation scene.
Yeah.
You know, I really did. I knew from early days that we were never going to see them graduate. I knew that all three of them we would not see them at school during what should have been their final year of education. But I really, during the final book, I kept thinking I felt sad that the book wasn't going to end with that feast scene, the graduation scene. But it couldn't, you know, it just couldn't. That's not the way it could have ended. It would have felt far too trite. And I mean, you know, a lot of people felt the epilogue was too sentimental. I think to have them, you know, a graduation scene on top of what had just happened would have been an absurd bit of anticlimax.
Did you have like ideas for kind of traditions that they would do, like, you know, ride the boats back out of Hogwarts
something? Definitely.
Obviously,
I think the boats would have been the most poetic and beautiful way to get for them to leave, and symbolic in that Harry wouldn't have seen the Thestrals again, you know what I mean? It would have been a return to innocence, really. And passage over water is so symbolic, in history of magic. So, yeah, it would be great.
You've just hit on something that happens all the time here on Pottercast. John says he throws out some nonsense thing that he just thought of off the top of his head.
It turns out to be accurate.
And then it's the perfect thing. And it turns out to be accurate. I can't tell you how much he got right in Deathly Hallows.
Well, I think I find that very interesting, because it's often those things that just strike you like lightning that are the right things. You know, sometimes you have to work very hard for something, and finally something shifts in your brain and you just say, yes, of course, that's it. But I love it. There's no better feeling than when it just comes out of nowhere and you think, perfect, thank you.
Don't forget to tune in next week, guys, for part 2 with J.K. Rowling.
We've missed it.
W3.
I confess myself disappointed.
Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to bed.
Great Scott, no wonder. Look at the time. We've been here nearly 4 hours. Spooky how the time flies when one's having fun.
This week's podcast was produced by the Podcast Trio and Steve Bonnet. Thanks, as always, to our awesome transcription elves for transcribing this and all our other episodes on Pottercast.com. For more information about the show and how to contact us and be a part of future episodes, visit Pottercast.com.
Ew, there's nothing you can tell your cauldron. It's getting all over my shoes.